Hello and welcome to another episode of the IUFRO Division 3 podcast series. I'm Preston Green, and along with co-host Woodham Chung, we are here in Linz, Austria, attending the 48th Formec International Symposium. Mr. Woodham, welcome.
Thank you, Preston. It's good to see you here.
For this episode, we are with Mr. Hans Heinemann from Switzerland. Mr. Heinemann, we would like to welcome you to the show as well.
Oh, welcome. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Mr. Woodham, would you start by introducing some of Mr. Heinemann's roles?
Sure, I'm very happy to introduce Professor Hans Heinemann. Well, Hans is a professor of forest engineering at ETH Zurich in Switzerland, and he was the former UFRO Division 3 coordinator. Well, I know you were assigned a new and very important position by ETH Zurich, and you moved to Singapore as the project leader of future resilient systems. Could you please explain about the future resilient systems project?
Yes, I'll try that. If you look at systems, the traditional way is to look back in history. What you observe in terms of events that happens, you fit some extreme value distribution, then you go to the tail, assume a characteristic upper value that constrain your system and design the system to resist against this strain. However, we see more and more events that are beyond this extreme value distribution, and we call them outliers or black swans, or some of them call them dragon kings. And so we have to find a new approach, how to design system to handle those shocks that are much larger than what we saw in the past.
Mr. Heinemann, the evolution you just described is a result of encountering events of magnitude outside of the system they were designed for, correct? Encountering those outlying events?
Yeah, that's correct. If such an event happens, we are going through different phases. Just immediately after a shock, we have the immediate reconfiguration of the system. For example, in a transportation system, it's just to reroute the traffic in the best possible way immediately. Then the next phase is to start the repair, the emergency repair, where you have always restrictions in terms of budget and manpower. And the question is, what is the best approach to invest the repair effort at what places to bring the system performance up again? And then this is followed by a third phase where we have to think about reconfiguring the whole system. That means in terms of a network, which nodes to take out or put new nodes in, or take edges out or put new edges in. And this is a big challenge because the network topology of many of our systems just evolved by evolution. It was never designed. And so to look at especially this topological approach is one of the key issues of what we're looking at.
I'm always fascinated by your presentations. And today also you gave a very nice presentation about forest road network and pavement engineering, and you always give not only state-of-the-art technologies but also historical evolution of those technologies that we enjoy today. Could you give us some ideas, how you'd view the technologies like harvesting systems and forest roads evolved?
I think every field of technology follows a path of evolution. And what I see is, at the very beginning, it's just the description of the best practices that people observe. This is where science started, usually. In France, somewhere in the 17th century, when the first textbook appears. The second step was when we started to look in a more systematic way at the single operations of single persons with tailor's work to optimize the movement, single movements. And so the unit of study was usually a specific task that a worker had to perform. Then the next step, I think, especially after the World War II, when mechanization started, the focus shifted to forestry machines. It started with the chainsaw, but then skidders came in especially. And so you will find a lot of people, a lot of papers just looking at machines, single machines as a focus of investigation. Then I think the next big shift was when the Swedes, together with Canadian researchers, started to look for fully mechanized harvesting systems. It was the first time in history when they used a systems engineering approach to the system design, and where a simulation came in to find out what is the best possible spatial layout of a harvesting system. So the boom reach of 8.5 meters at that time was clearly a result of the simulations that they did at that time. At the same time, people like Dennis Dijkstra and Andres Weintraub also started to look at systems from an optimization point of view, with mathematical formulations of road network layout, harvest layout, and things like that. So I think this was the major driving force somewhere in the 1970s. And then I see a new paradigm on the horizon. It's the network approach, where people look at whole networks. One example is supply networks. I think supply chain is a little bit narrow. In reality, it's more supply networks. But also networks in terms of technology. Just an example, I think every technology is not only the technical part, the engineered system, but it's always the operators plus the operating organization as a whole that make the whole performance, what is good or bad, or whatever we judge. And to bring this together and to not look separately at the organization and on the operations, I think that's one of the biggest challenges ahead.
That's related to the resilience system that you've been looking at, right? So all the, you know, different elements within the system, they are connected through network.
Absolutely.
And we need to understand how they are connected.
Absolutely.
And how they react different shocks and different external forces.
Absolutely. And up to now, it was extremely difficult to find representations to study this type of phenomena. And with the emerging theory of complex networks, we have a whole tool set that is ready to be used. And I think there is a lot of potential that we also in forestry, I think the theory of complex networks could really become very important in the future.
So your idea of large-scale resiliency, is that a good way to summarize it, large-scale resiliency?
Absolutely. So let's try to think a little bit through an example. I think if you look at resilience in forestry, the spatial scale is probably not the stand, but the catchment. And you have different types of processes going on different spatial scales. The largest process set is the disturbance agents that act in a certain catchment, causing windstorms, calamities, and so on. And this is only studied, let's say, from a biological point of view, how it works. But I think the future will be that we take that as somewhat a governing process that governs what we are implementing in terms of silvicultural regimes. And this is an example how to link the large-scale process to our silvicultural layout that is somewhat linked. And then also the silvicultural operations put into practice by our operational methods. And I could imagine that in the future we are looking a little bit more holistically to try to optimize the whole.
So for this large-scale resiliency to be effective, you have to start by knowing what kind of resiliency you want to design for, correct?
That's correct. In the real end, resilience is always about some performance related to specific service. So we have to define different measures of performance. And at the beginning, if you only have one dimension, one measure of performance, resilience is maybe a concept that you can handle easily. On the other hand, I think the challenging thing is, especially if we look at natural systems, we always have a whole portfolio of measures of performance. And this, I think, is one of the biggest challenges ahead to explore to how to handle this.
During our conversation together, Woodham, we talked about the lack of graduate and PhD students in the U.S., but what we left out of that was the acknowledgement that this is really a worldwide problem. Other members here at the Format Conference have echoed our thoughts very clearly about their need for students to fill these important roles as well. Hans, what are your thoughts on that topic?
I totally agree that this is a worldwide problem. It's a problem of our forest engineering community. And I think one first step could be to install a type of incubator for PhD students that could go along with different conferences, along with a funding mechanism to provide funds for traveling. And I think one of the main issues is to bring people together to reframe our views, how we see the problems. Psychologists call that mental models in our head. And instead of, let's say, go through a series of presentations, I would love to have workshops just to work on these joint models. How do we see the future? It's somewhat horizon scanning. What do you see as forest engineering on the horizon to develop a joint vision? And it's interesting, Woody, you mentioned that in history, we can learn also. It was this informal college that was there in the 1950s and 60s, and it consisted of four main people. It was Ulf Sundberg in Sweden, it was Ivar Samset in Norway, it was Hans-Jörg Steinlin, Germany, Switzerland, and it was Kalle Puut-Kisto. And sometimes we had also Ross Silversides. And they met informally in some summer house. And they did this mental modeling, what is out there. And the interesting thing, if Hans-Jörg Steinlin told me that this way of thinking also caused quite a lot of conflict, because many people acting as full professors at that time totally disagreed with the view of those people. But I think it demonstrated, if you look back, that it was necessary at the time, and it was a huge push coming out of that. So the incubator is somewhat trying to learn from what they did and combining that with what we have today.
Yeah, Division 3 has been much influenced by you, your passion and your enthusiasm about education. So actually Division 3 plans to have forest engineering graduate student conference next year, hopefully in Oregon State. And I really hope that they can get together and share their ideas and build new ideas from them. And also they can build a really cohort at early stage of their career, yeah, which is very important for networking.
Absolutely. That's excellent.
So your enthusiasm and passion still live with Division 3. So how do you think, you know Division 3, what direction we should go?
You know, that's I know how UFRO works. I understand a little bit since my role as a coordinator. However, it's a voluntary organization, and what I learned is probably the only way that you can go is to follow the phrase strategy follows people, to identify key people are willing to contribute, because it's not a company that you can manage. So you can only select people who are willing to do something, and to tolerate that you have also people that are on paper somewhat willing to contribute, but maybe in practice not able or not willing to do something, I think that's fine. It's just a matter of this type of organization.
I think it's really important to share ideas as well as realize the challenges that we are facing together, and hopefully we can find some solutions together within Division 3. And we laid out a lot of challenges already. We discussed about them. Hopefully this podcast can be used to discuss about those challenges and find solutions.
That wraps up this episode of the IUFRO Division 3 podcast series from the 2015 Format Conference on Forestry Mechanization in Linz, Austria. Future episodes will also feature participants from the Format Conference, so be sure to not miss those. I am the host, Preston Green, and on behalf of Mr. Woodham Chung, we would like to thank Mr. Heinemann once again for the time to be on the show, but more importantly, for his contributions to IUFRO and modern forestry research. Thank you, Mr. Heinemann.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
For more information about this podcast, please visit the IUFRO website, www.iufro.org. IUFRO Division 3 podcasts are produced by myself and Woodham Chung with support from Faye and Lucille Stewart Endowment Funds at Oregon State University.